from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a possible coup in Burundi.
There were some major protests this morning. We were right in the middle of it in the Musaga neighborhood of Bujumbura. This has been the scene of a lot of clashes during the demonstrations the past few weeks.
Gunmen in Pakistan kill 45 in an assault on a commuter bus. A Muslim scholar speaks about violence from that community and reimagining forests to help feed the planet. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A general says he has ousted the Burundian president, who left the country to attend a regional summit on Burundi's political crisis. Correspondent Gabe Joselow is in the capital, Bujumbura, and spoke with VOA's Pete Heinlein.
There were some major protests this morning. We were right in the middle of it in the Musaga neighborhood of Bujumbura. This has been the scene of a lot of clashes during the demonstrations the past few weeks. Basically, the protesters trapped the police from two sides, approached on two separate fronts, and the throwing stones, throwing some Molotov cocktails in some instances, and the police responded mostly with tear gas. We also heard a lot of gunshots. We saw them firing water cannons as well to disperse the protesters. This was one of the biggest protests and the biggest clashes since these demonstrations began. But they have been going on like this on a daily basis for the last few weeks.
Now, what's the difference between these clashes and what we're hearing are celebrations? Are they two separate things or are they intermingled?
They're very separate things right now. The celebrations that we're seeing have been pretty joyful. It's really a party in the streets of Bujumbura right now. There has been some sort of looting of police stations that seems to be a part of these celebrations. And it's certainly a lot of the same people who have been out demonstrating the past few weeks who are involved in these celebrations. But they have a very different tone. This is all celebratory, whereas the clashes, feel very tense, can be very fierce, and are obviously quite violent.
We know that General Niyombare, who announced the dismissal of President Nkurunziza, is a respected figure. But can you tell us, is this coup for real, for sure, or is it possible that the president could return tomorrow and reclaim power?
That is exactly the question that we and many other people in Burundi are asking themselves at this moment. It's not certain that this commander speaks for the entire armed forces or if he is speaking for an individual faction. And already we've seen the Burundi presidency deny that there's any coup taking place and that the situation is under control. So we're waiting to see what could happen in the coming days. I think if it could be a big problem if these people who are out celebrating today find out tomorrow that, in fact, the president is still sticking around and that their efforts have so far been in vain. And I worry that there could be further violence if that is the case.
What about the scene around the radio station there? Apparently, there were troops around the radio station facility. Can you describe that?
Yes, we heard reports that there were soldiers surrounding the state media broadcaster. There have also been reports of some gunfire from that area, but it didn't seem that there was actually fighting. Maybe it was soldiers shooting in the air to disperse any sort of crowds that were gathering there. We are still trying to figure out, though, however, if these are soldiers who are aligned with the president or with the new coup leaders, if we want to call it a coup. So, again, still a lot of information we're trying to sort out about that situation.
Now, you gave us a description of the celebrations in the streets, but for the most part, would you say business as usual, or is this quite different? Are stores open, shops open, people traveling easily?
Today, the downtown area of Bujumbura was pretty well shut down. There are people in the streets. There were small protests around and a heavy police presence, but it certainly didn't feel like a normal day. I think a lot of stores were closed as the protesters sort of descended on city center, which they hadn't done before. And in the side streets, in the residential neighborhoods, there are still roadblocks. There are burning tires. There's broken glass. There's occasional skirmishes and a lot of moving protests. So, no, I wouldn't say that it feels like business as usual. It certainly feels like you're in the middle of a movement here, or as some people have called it, a revolution.
Do you personally feel safe? Is everything okay there?
We've felt safe. We were a little bit close to a hairy situation earlier when the clashes were taking place in Musaga. We got trapped between the two lines of protesters and the police. Luckily, the police and the protesters have been very kind to the media and very respectful. So the press have been able to move about freely, but there are stones being thrown, there's tear gas, there's water cannons. So there's danger everywhere. But the press so far has not been targeted. I haven't felt like that I've been targeted at all.
VOA correspondent Gabe Joslow in the Burundi capital, Bujumbura. Burundi has been rocked by protests since April 26, when the president announced he will run for a third term. Critics say a third term would be unconstitutional, while the president and his supporters insist it is legal because he was chosen by lawmakers, not a general election, for his first five-year term in 2005. Burundi's constitutional court has ruled in the president's favor. The president traveled to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, today for a summit of the five-nation East African community. The EAC called the summit to discuss the increasing turmoil in Burundi. The unrest has sparked worries Burundi could slip back into civil war. Some 300,000 Burundians were killed during a 13-year war that ended in 2006. Authorities in Pakistan say a gunman ambushed a bus in Karachi today, killing 45 people, including women. The victims belong to the minority Shiite Ismaili Muslim community. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Police and witnesses say the packed bus was transporting members of the minority community to their workplaces when it was ambushed in a relatively secluded part of Karachi. Some survivors told the police that passengers thought the gunmen wanted to rob them and immediately offered all their belongings for sparing their lives. But the assailants ordered them to put their heads down and open fire. Hospital officials said that more than a dozen women are among the dead, while several survivors are being treated for serious bullet injuries. Provincial Police Chief Ghulam Haider Jamali discussed details of the initial probe. He told reporters that six gunmen riding motorbikes intercepted and entered the bus and sprayed the passengers with bullets. The attackers then fled the scene, located in a relatively deserted neighborhood under construction on the outskirts of Karachi. In Islamabad, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was chairing a so-called all-parties conference when he was informed of the attack. He denounced the bloodshed, saying it is a worrying development that the terrorists are now targeting Pakistan's peaceful and innocent communities that have stayed away from controversies. The Pakistani minority Ismaili community is considered progressive and largely non-political, working mostly in the health and education sectors. The southern commercial hub Karachi has long been the site of ethnic, religious and political violence. The government recently launched a security operation in the city of nearly 20 million people using a paramilitary force called the Rangers. Authorities have rounded up hundreds of suspected criminals, killers, and kidnappers. A majority of the detainees belong to Karachi's dominant political force, Muttahida Qaumi Movement, or MQM. The party, representing the city's majority Urdu-speaking population, alleges the security operation is politically motivated. In March, the paramilitary force raided MQM's headquarters and captured sophisticated heavy and other weapons together with fugitives of law, including murder convicts. Islamist militants linked to the Pakistani Taliban are also believed to be operating in Karachi and blamed for some of the deadly attacks both on civilians and police personnel. The insurgents, entrenched in tribal areas near the Afghan border, are blamed for killing thousands of Pakistanis in suicide bombings and other terrorist attacks in response to security operations against their strongholds. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
A group called the American Freedom Defensive Initiative in the U.S. state of Texas recently sponsored a cartoon contest offering a $10,000 prize for a selected drawing of Islam's Prophet Muhammad. Many Muslims consider depiction of the Prophet as blasphemy. Two gunmen arrived on the scene and had a shootout with police, wounding one security guard before being shot dead themselves. Pamela Geller is president of the group that sponsored the event, and we asked her why she held the contest.
It was a Muhammad art exhibit and contest held in Garland because in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo jihad slaughter, Muslim groups in Texas, in that same venue, in that same room, held a conference, Stand with the Prophet, in support of the Sharia restrictions on free speech. And it was a pity, because what a great time to stand for freedom of speech. So we felt that we ought to stand for freedom of speech, and that's why we did it in that space, in that venue.
We were prepared for some trouble, though.
No. Look, the work that we do has long been controversial. The media self-enforces the Sharia. The media criticizes anyone that opposes the jihad or Sharia. So we always have protection. We always have security at our events. This is going on for years. So I didn't anticipate trouble, but it wasn't entirely surprising.
You were aware that many Muslims find this blasphemous.
I'm not a Muslim. I don't adhere to the Sharia. I find many of the things the media says to be deeply offensive. You know, here's the thing. In a pluralistic society, offensive speech is protected. That's what keeps us free.
And the United States stands for many people being here with different cultures, religions. Do you have respect for these other religions?
I have respect for everyone, but they have to have respect for my free speech. The cartoons are only provocative to those who adhere to the Sharia laws. So I don't.
What do you hope to accomplish with this cartoon contest?
I hope to raise awareness of the encroaching Sharia in this country, which is painfully clear in this latest episode. I mean, the story should not be about me. It should be, first off, about the two jihadists that were killed. What was the ideology? What was the motive? What incited them? The fact that we smoked out a terrorist cell, the fact that we now have the military on the highest since 9/11, bravo, threat alert. I mean, if there was a responsible media, we would be talking about the positive developments from this. But no, it's all about me and my motives. My motives are in defense of freedom.
You feel you're a good American?
I'm a proud American, yeah.
In fairness, we recently had on our program Ibrahim Huber, the National Communications Director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and he used the word bigot. He accused you of being a bigot. What is your reaction to his remarks?
Of course he did. I don't know why the media has designated them some legitimate authority. CARE was named an unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terrorist funding trial in our nation's history, the Holy Land Foundation trial. The UAE designated CARE a terrorist group. Half of their leadership are serving crimes for jihad-related terror, and you're asking me why he called me a bigot? He's an Islamic supremacist. CARE is a front for Hamas.
Do the Muslims scare you?
No. Losing my freedom scares me. The Muslims don't scare me. The Muslims are lovely. I have a problem with the ideology. I have a problem with jihadic doctrine, and I have a problem with the most brutal and extreme system of governance on the face of the earth, the Sharia.
Pamela Geller, president of American Freedom Defense Initiative. ISIS claimed responsibility for the shooting at the Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas and warned more attacks to come. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with American Muslim scholar Yasser Qadhi, professor of religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, about the fine lines between freedoms of speech and hate speech and why some Muslims resort to violence or terrorism out of anger.
Professor Qadhi, if Prophet Muhammad himself did not respond to personal attacks and mocking by violence, how would some Muslims today kill people who draw cartoons depicting the Prophet?
That's a very good question. We all know as Muslims that the Prophet Muhammad always turned the other cheek. He was very forgiving to those who opposed him. And this is the image that Muslims have of the Prophet. Now, it is true that some people outside the faith try to portray the Prophet as a warmonger, as this and that. But the image that Muslims have of their Prophet is really similar to the image that Christians have of Jesus. And that is that he was a loving, a peaceful Prophet who forgave his opponents. And there are many instances in the life of the Prophet that Muslims grew up hearing about. So the question arises, where is this anger and where is this justification coming from? And the response to this is that one cannot ignore the socio-political context from within which these provocations arise. The fact of the matter is that Islam has been slandered for the last 14 centuries. Like every religion, people go back and forth. But it is not common in the history of Islam to have radical terrorist groups or to have vigilantes going and killing people, you know, who defamed the Prophet. This is a relatively modern phenomenon. The very notion of Islamic terrorism is relatively modern. It only goes back to the 70s and early 80s. And one does need to ask, why is this happening only recently? And the response is that one cannot ignore the political dimension, pre-colonialism, post-colonialism, the invasions of so many Muslim lands, the support of dictator regimes. All of these things are not simply disparate issues. They are interconnected. And when a community feels marginalized, and I can assure you the Muslim community is feeling marginalized, any type of attack on that which is sacred and holy kind of brings out all of those emotions, all of those tensions. And it is a sad reality that, yes, when you attack the Prophet, you are going to get these reactions. It's almost inevitable. Pamela Geller did seem to be instigating and gleefully accepting the fact that she was attacked. She was banking on it because it did boost her to a level of popularity that she now has.
But Professor, American Muslim youth had been spared the alienation that fostered militancy in Europe. How do you explain homegrown terrorism by some Muslim Americans?
You know, I used to say around 6-7 years ago that all Islamic jihadist terrorist attacks by Muslims have occurred by people who were not born and raised in America. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we've actually seen a few instances, just a handful, and the two individuals as well that were responsible for the Dallas shooting, they are as well American. The one was a convert, and the other was born and raised here from a Muslim father. It's just a sad reality that, unfortunately, unless we take a step back and ask ourselves why there is so much anger. I mean, again, let me give you an analogous situation. Look at Ferguson, look at Baltimore, look at the tensions within the African-American and the larger dominant Caucasian populations. You cannot dissociate this ongoing narrative. And if a young African-American does something, let's say in New York, you can ask him, why would you get irritated when you're not in Ferguson, you're not in Baltimore? But see, there is this alliance. There is this notion of all of us are being attacked. And frankly, there's an element of truth in that narrative. So it is true that, yes, eventually even American Muslims will fall prey to that narrative that ISIS is spreading, that other groups are spreading, that all Muslims are under attack, all Muslims are under siege, that they're out to get you. This war on terror is nothing other than a war on Islam. And when we continue our foreign policies, we continue our drones and our assassinations and our supporting of military dictators, when we selectively choose who to defend and who not to defend, i.e. the innocent Syrians that are being massacred, they're not being defended. When we selectively choose, then that narrative is given certain, you know, credence, and people do fall prey to it. And this is not a justification. Of course, I strongly disagree with that narrative, but it is inevitable when blood is continued to be shed, when violence is continued to be perpetrated, that more and more people will identify with the victims and feel that they need to do something against those whom they view as being actively involved in propagating that violence.
American Muslim scholar Yasser Qadhi, professor of religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Thursday on International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute. I am Rick Pantaleo. After studying parts of a fossilized skull of a dinosaur that had been thought to be a member of a previously identified species, researcher Stephen Jasinski from the University of Pennsylvania realized that he had actually discovered a new species of dinosaur. The researcher found that this new lizard-like species is closely related to the Velociraptor, the notorious band of dinosaurs from the movie Jurassic Park, and was probably an intimidating predator due to its powerful sense of smell. Scientists believe the fossil was around 75 million years old. Jasinski has named his new dinosaur species Sarwornith olestes sullivani. The skull fossil that led to Jasinski's findings was discovered in New Mexico in 1999 by paleontologist Robert Sullivan. And that's your science in a minute.
The world population is expected to climb to 9 billion by 2050. By that time, the demand for food will double. Exactly how to accommodate those needs in the future is a concern today, especially for the more than 800 million people who go to bed hungry. According to a major report, the forests, if managed properly, could provide some help to reduce hunger and improve nutrition. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel has details.
Some of the world's best honey comes from forests in southern Cambodia, says Sai Ye Viyun, a group leader with the Cambodian Federation for Bee Conservation. He says they work with five local honey buyers, who in turn work with 42 honey collectors. They learn what's best for the forest and what's best for the bees. They carefully harvest honey that delights customers like Hug Lung, who gets a taste of the produce in a store in Phnom Penh. She says it smells very fresh, like fresh flowers. You can tell it's natural honey from the jungle. Healthy forests give us half the fresh fruit we consume. They produce valuable commodities like coffee, avocados, cashews, and other seeds and nuts high in nutrients that are popular on the world market. Tree foods can also be a safety net for people living in and around the forest, according to the new report released at the United Nations by the International Union of Forest Research Organizations, or UFRO. Bhaskar Vira is director of the University of Cambridge Conservation Research Institute and chaired the UFRO panel. He says tree foods can supplement traditional agriculture, not replace it.
Like an insurance policy, having access to those tree-based foods is hugely important when you can't buy food from other sources or when you can't produce food because your fields have failed.
Yet agriculture is a major driver of deforestation. Vera says the two can coexist, even complement each other, if managed properly.
The neglect of those forest foods is one of the reasons why people are willing to clear them and convert them over to agriculture. We're arguing that you should think about that landscape as a much more integrated production landscape. But by doing so, by doing what people are calling sustainable intensification, by enhancing yields in one part of the landscape, you can actually free up space in other parts of the landscape to retain the forests and the trees that are so important for the other products and services that they provide.
The report finds that when people who live in or near the forest are given greater control over the landscape and its resources, forest health and its economic value improve. Take, for example, the locally managed agroforestry project in Ghana, where people hope to reap profits from alambakia, a fruit-bearing plant. The oil from its seed can be used in soaps, beauty products, and food. Project coordinator Okai Michael Henchard sees great potential for the local community.
They get additional income. They get trees on their land. They provide shade to their cuckoo. And then, collectively, we restore the land. This is a tree that also sequesters carbon. So this is also helping in fighting the climate change.
Bhaskar Vira cautions that over-harvesting can mean ruin for new products like alambakia, as well as established ones.
We don't want to be in a situation where we are over-exploiting this resource and then reducing its long-term sustainability. So we have to be quite vigilant, especially when you start to get market values being imposed upon these commodities and the desire for short-term profitability sometimes competing with the long-term sustainability of the resource.
The report underscores the importance of reimagining forested and agricultural landscapes through careful management and good governance. Bhaskar Vira says if done right, it can help alleviate hunger and poverty worldwide. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.